Welcome today to our presentation session. For those that don't know me, I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust that hosts these sessions along with the City Library and also Chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group. Our speaker today is no stranger to you, and in fact I said I wasn't going to go through a long list. I'll leave that to Peter himself if he wishes. Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Peter Wood, who's the Director of the New Zealand War Study Centre at the Defence College, Staff College down in Trentham, has become one of our regular speakers, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to talk to us today about some 80th anniversary activities that are very close to home. So without further ado, would you please welcome Peter.
Afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the introduction, Joe. And thank you all for coming along to hear. It's really a double presentation, sort of half devoted to two topics, the Army Staff College and Linton Camp. It's their 80th anniversary. So a good opportunity just to remember those two organisations, one now defunct, but with successes, the other one now very much alive, and the close association between those two organisations, Palmerston North and the Manawatū, the military and the university. I'm not old enough to have gone to that Staff College, but I did do the Australian Army one. I now work out of the New Zealand Command and Staff College, the successor to this. I had a couple of postings to Linton Camp with the 1st Battalion, 2IC and CO. But my first brush with Linton Military Camp was a young infantry second lieutenant. I went to the School of Military Engineering to undertake a demolitions course. So I learned to blow things up and went around various paddocks and blew up trees and bits and pieces. But one of the jobs I remember really well was as an officer, I had to go and do a reconnaissance of the old Fitzherbert Bridge and then do all the calculations about how to blow it up. So that was quite an interesting thing. It's now gone, of course, but and taken down by engineers, but not sort of blown up. So I want to cast ourselves back though 81 years to the situation confronted by New Zealand in 1941 and 42. So 1941, defeat after defeat overseas, the New Zealand Expeditionary Force and others, Air Force and others have been involved. The Japanese have started their advance into the Pacific. And even in 1942, Singapore had fallen, Darwin was bombed, New Zealand was expecting an invasion, and in the Manawatū Standard, there appears this article saying that we've got 50,000 Home Guard, we need another 50,000 Home Guard. And even a New Zealand steamer, the Hauraki, I won't cover it in any detail now, maybe in question time, was captured by the Japanese. So there was a palpable threat that New Zealanders perceived at the time, at a time when many of our men were offshore with the NZEF. That's the extent of the Japanese advance at about the time in question. And here is the commanding officer of the Melrose Battalion of the Home Guard. He's put out an order. He wants an aggressive defence against a large-scale landing in the Wellington area and to conduct counterattacks. So at this time, it was expected that the Japanese might possibly attempt a landing or raiding. So what I'll cover then this afternoon is just want to introduce Geoffrey Perrin, talk a little bit about the Army Staff College and the Linton Camp, and then summarise them there. I don't think any discussion of these two organisations would be complete without covering off Geoffrey Perrin. He's a Brit. He joined the British Army during the First World War. He was an artillery officer, got a Croix de Guerre, nominated for the Military Cross. After the war, he becomes an academic and ends up coming to New Zealand, where he's a founder of the Massey Agricultural College. But at the same time, he joins and later commands the Manawatū Mounted Rifles and is appointed to command the division that was based here or headquartered out of here. But he also facilitates the Army Staff College going to Massey. So we'll just go now on to the Staff College, and here's the photo 80 years ago today. I'm not sure what they would have been doing on the 10th of March, but anyway, that's them at the end of the course. So why did there need to be a Staff College? So in 1941, the British were invited to send out a senior officer, he was an engineer, to do a survey of New Zealand from a defensive point of view. So where could Japanese or others land? So he went pretty much from Cape Raglan down to the bottom of the South Island. And at the same time, he discovered that many of the Home Guard and other officers knew very little about the military at all, and even less about the other corps. So if you were in the infantry and you didn't know about the artillery or the engineers or the logistics, there was going to be a problem in a proper defence of New Zealand against what would be a pretty organised enemy of divisional sort of strength landing. So he decides that one way to remedy that would be the establishment of a Staff College, which he recommends, that it runs staff and command courses. So that's the difference between being a commander, brigade commander, battalion commander of artillery or engineers or infantry, but also the staff officers that prepare and run the logistics, the ammunition, the sighting of the guns, coordinate the fire support, talk to the Air Force about bombing and support. So you need to train them as well, otherwise you'll quickly lose the capacity to defend. He requested that the UK provide a commandant and a number of directing staff, DS we call them today, and he also recommended that the syllabus be based on the defence of New Zealand. So rather than think about Japan or Asia or what was going on in the Middle East, focus the whole course on the defence of New Zealand. And that, in that case, it's rather a unique course. So the British officer we got out here was this colonel then, but eventually Brigadier Hawkins. He was an infantry officer from the Lancashire Fusiliers. He was on a posting working with General Sir Archibald Wavell, expecting his next job to be a battalion command, a brigade command, but he gets tapped on the shoulder by General Wavell and said, "I need you to go to New Zealand to set up a staff college over there." So he does that, he arrives, only to find that the recommended location is Wairuru. Not a good thing, and he quickly decides that that's not a good plan, and through a series of events facilitated by Brigadier Weir, he meets Geoffrey Perrin, and Geoffrey Perrin organises with the Massey principals and staff that the Staff College could be located there. And so he's arrived in September, and the first staff course is going in January. That is a quick flash to bang, setting up a course. So the purpose of the college, 80 years ago, train and test officers for command and staff in New Zealand, train the staff appointments and prepare for operations in New Zealand. There's your course. Students, staff sitting down the front. There's a couple of Brits in there. There's the occasional Air Force. Probably not a student at this time, more to advise the students on how to request and get and use Air Force support in the defence of, or in support of Army operations. So they ran a number of types of courses. There was a senior officer's course, so that COs and brigade commanders could quietly be instructed in how to run their units. Staff officers' courses, they ended up running two types, a longer one and then a shorter, more junior course. And then they started running tactical courses, how to actually fight the battles, and then support them with engineers and artillery and the like. And I'll put that picture in there because it just reminds you of the kind of individuals that these New Zealand staff officers and commanders were expected to command. The staff officers course, I don't want to go through the detail of it, but there's a problem. Of the 49 students that arrive on the course, only 26 pass. This is because Hawkins understands that there's no point attending a course, getting a pass and being given a job, because that could be fatal. If you can't do that job in the real defence of your country, then you shouldn't be what they call SC staff qualified. I think we're PSC now, past staff college. So 26 passed, 12 were not recommended. Some of them were over their 50s, and you come straight out of a solicitor's office. Some of them had barely been in a unit and knew nothing about the army, and three or four students had basically been warned out the day before the course that they needed to come and do it. So there were a whole lot of issues going on, which meant that they weren't suitable. But the difference, so 9-day gap between the courses, that is a really short time to put basically 100 students through, and pretty intense for the staff, but 40 of the 50 students passed this time round. So already they're taking a look at the entry qualifications. So officers that go have had some regimental experience, artillery, engineers, logistics, infantry, whatever, and possibly some staff experience. The other thing is that two Air Force students come along as well, and they're probably not pilots, but they're probably ground liaison officers who will now understand army operations, and then being posted to a squadron can then advise the Air Force on how the army might be thinking and operating. And this is a picture, it's not a very good one unfortunately, but these are students watching smoke being laid down by a troop of tanks. So a lot of the tension was lectures, sand models, and then going and looking at demonstrations, then going out in the field and running a tactical exercise, even if it's just on mat and table with discussions. So they did all those sort of subjects, so how to prepare staff work, and how many trucks do you need to take all the ammunition to the gun line, how long will it take to get there and offload it and bring it back, all those sorts of things. Tactics at brigade group level, so not minor tactics section sort of thing of 10 or 30 soldiers, we're talking a few thousand soldiers now, three infantry battalions, an artillery regiment, tank squadron or regiment of assigned engineers to do bridging and demolitions, logistics to bring forward ammunition, take out casualties. So they were trying to put all that stuff together. River crossings, lots of them in New Zealand. You had to be able to know how to cross rivers with or without the support of the engineers, how long it would take them to build those bridges, what weight of vehicles could go over them. The organisation, so the infantry, you need to know a bit about the artillery and a bit about the engineers and vice versa. Intelligence, how to get information about Japanese plans and intentions and turn that into plans for defence, how to administer your organisation, how to train them. So no good commanding a unit and prior to the invasion actually not running proper training, so they had to learn that. Operations in New Zealand, and basically at the end of the day they had to learn how to cooperate with the Air Force and even brief pilots on reconnaissance-type tasks. And that's the sort of thing you even learn a bit about today. So here we have a group of students attending a lecture. It was plastic over the photograph that I took, so it hasn't come out too well, but that's a typical setting. So you get presentations, you end up in a tutorial, usually four or five syndicates. You discuss with the artillery, the engineers, your directing staff, how things will go. Then they'll lay all it all out on a sand model and talk about how things might work. And then finally there'd be outdoor exercises and demonstrations. And army students and staff college students today, this is exactly, you know, the sort of thing that's done. So here's the staff college's maneuver map. You can understand, you know, Japanese land here, you know, where are we going to defend, where will the infantry be, where are the gun lines going to go, how do you withdraw, what if there's, you know, then you can work it all out on a map. And then test the students and discuss the plans for defence, or how to get yourself down to defend or bolster up the Wellington defence. And then finally, visiting speakers. So here's a couple of Americans. The Air Attaché, his experiences at Pearl Harbor, and Brigadier Hurley about the organisation of the American Army being invited by the Staff College to come and talk. So visiting speakers would come along. So where did they stay? Well, this is Massey University, 1943. The Sir Geoffrey Perrin building still exists. Magnificent building. If you haven't had a look at it, you should do. These are the huts that the students lived in. Now that's the refectory, which still operates. You've got some staff buildings here. And just down at the bottom here, it's not very clear, unfortunately, is the foundations for the next McCarty Hall, which I'll show next. So the Massey Board offers the Army the main building, the Geoffrey Perrin building, as it becomes known later on in its life, the hostel for students. Army pays for the use of facilities and ends up taking over the caterer, and it's quite a good relationship because the number of messy students has dwindled because they're all off at war. And so the army coming in and running a staff course basically utilises the facilities and also provides a cash flow, because the army also buys off the university not only meat from the farms that the college runs, but vegetables and things like that. So it's a pretty good relationship. And the Acacia Birch House is also taken over for the staff. So this is McCarty Hall that's built. And you can see there's a number of the students going into the accommodation there. And that's a little bit what it looks like today. You know, overgrown now, trees and all the rest of it. But that was built for the army students. There's a rumour, well, there's a common held truth in the army that the Whareratu building up at Massey was where the staff college was, probably because of the links to the Russell family, but that's not so. The Acacia Birch House was taken over for the staff. Good idea to separate after hours some of the staff from the students, get them out of the area, you can do your own thing separately, and it was considerable restructuring of accommodation, extensions to the kitchen and the dining areas, reticulation, they put in huts for additional accommodation, they expanded the gardens, and they kept that on until about March 1944 when the staff college closed down. I couldn't find any pictures of Whareratu. All I did find in the files, plans drawn up by engineers to reconstruct the interior of the building. And then, of course, it closed. Massive enrolment started to increase in about 1943, and there was competition for the space. But also, it was decided that there really wasn't a need any further for a staff college facility to be being run. And it wasn't just the staff college. Many other units and things started to be shut down across New Zealand when they were decided that they were surplus to requirement. But 500 students had gone through over the period of time. That is a pretty good load. I mean, our staff colleges probably put through 30 to 50 students in a year. 500 going through there with that number of staff is a great effort. And a further bonus for the university was that those buildings that were built, a lot of that stuff was gifted across. Some of it was sold across, but a lot of it was gifted across to the university. So, you know, for Perrin and the army and the university, it was a really beneficial period, and certainly served to increase the capacity of the Home Guard and the New Zealand Defence Force. And a number of the officers that went through those courses ended up serving with the 3rd Division or even in the 2nd Division, so they took that training and experience forward with them. So today, the Army doesn't have a staff college, it has the tactical school, and it runs the Grade 3 and the Grade 2 staff and tactics courses. They would be almost exactly the same as they were then, only different weapon systems and all that sort of thing, slightly different organisations, but the same kind of discussions and tutorials and what we call TUTES, Tactical Exercise Without Troops. And there's a number of students last year in the paddocks, somewhere between Linton and Massey University. Those white things are their map boards, and individually they are working out a problem, I don't know, an attack or a defence, and they're going to be assessed on their solution there. And it's not just their tactical solution, but it's how they employ the artillery, the engineers, the logistics, and how they think about how the enemy will operate and how they will counter that in their particular operation. The Command and Staff College closed. The Air Force then ran their own college for a period of time up in Auckland. And for a long period, Army would send 4 or 5 students to it, Navy would send a few students to it, but most of us went overseas to the Australian Army Staff College. But since 2002, it's been a joint Army-Navy-Air Force organisation, the student body, and indeed we have members of other government departments, New Zealand Police, civilians come along as well, and there's the graduation of a course in 2020. Course number 63, just saw them the other day, they're well underway, they'll graduate at the end of the year. So, and the other thing that came out of this was the relationship between the Defence Force and Massey University, and the establishment of what was then the Centre for Defence and Strategic Studies, or now the Centre for Defence and Security Studies. So that's the legacy of Perrin and Hawkins and the decision to set up an Army Staff College here in the Manawatū. One of the reasons for the Manawatū being chosen was it was also a lot closer to the defence headquarters in Wellington, where students could more easily be visited by people coming up from defence headquarters and stuff, but also the ground and the weather was a whole lot better as much today. But the reason it's in Trentham now is very similar proximity to the defence headquarters and the joint headquarters. We'll just move on to Linton Camp. For now, we know it as Linton Military Camp. For a period it was Camp Kairanga. And Kairanga, I think the name stems back to pre-European times, where that area with the swamps and the creeks was food, a place to gather food. And, you know, eels, freshwater crayfish, flax would be growing. I mean, all sorts of kai was to be found down there. And the name Camp Whitmore comes from just out from Camp Road now, on the main road out past Linton towards Whitmore, a block was opened up for sale of land. The block was being surveyed by one Captain Priest, New Zealand Cross from the New Zealand Wars, and his commander, who put him in for the New Zealand Cross, was Colonel Whitmore. And I think we think that's how the name Whitmore got attached to that particular piece of land. But anyway, for a period, probably a year or so, the names Kairanga and Whitmore were used, but settled by about 1943 to be the Linton Military Camp. And there you can see kind of the extent of it with some of the huts that were there in 1950. And the little towers are probably water going down the ablution blocks, I would think. So, again, the need for this camp stemmed from General Williams. I mean, he did a fantastic job for the couple of months he was in New Zealand and in Fiji. He decided that formation or brigade-level forces were what was required if he needed to hold the Japanese off at the beach and then ram in other brigade forces to deal with them. He created a lot of army schools, or recommended the creation of army schools in Trentham, armour in Wairu, artillery in Wellington, mountain warfare in Wairu, tactics in Whanganui, and the Staff College. And he wanted a camp like Linton being built for 4,000 to 5,000 men of the 2nd Infantry Brigade through there. And you can see the kind of layout. This is just the North Island, but, you know, we're part of the Central Military District, and Palmerston North had the 2nd Infantry Brigade headquarters, which Perrin ends up commanding. So the construction, the land is taken under the Public Works Act for construction. It begins pretty early in January 42, and already the artillery regiment moves in and lives under canvas on site. So you've got some soldiers there. It's 700 acres. More than half of it is tree stumps and stuff like that. All that stuff's got to be cleared away, drainage done, roads built. They were going to build 9 blocks in the camp. In the end, they only built 7, and the 8th block was and still is the area where the public works, or I think now Serco or Lockheed Martin are located outside the camp. Yep. Most of the work being done, a huge number of members of the public works department and the contractors worked on site. But, you know, you ended up by the end of 44 with a 50-bed hospital, nurses' home, theatre, wet and dry canteens, magazines for ammunition to be stored, armouries and weapons, and then the ordnance and quartermaster stores and the workshops. So it's really starting to take shape. And there's some of the huts all lined up really regimentally. And also, there was a 25-yard rifle range built on the banks of the Kahutera stream, probably where they'd had a bit of a quarry. And there's a nice letter from Mr. Keeble to the Ministry of Defence asking that they do something about the range, because many of the bullets have been shooting over the top of his farmhands, and they've even picked some of the bullets out of the wooden fence post. So, you know, yeah, there was a few issues with the neighbours. So early occupants, as I mentioned, the artillery got in there pretty quickly under tents, and then other regiments started to occupy the different blocks. And this shows quite clearly, and this is probably the current Kent Road, this is a 1970s map, but still block 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is out there, 6 and 7, and those are pretty familiar. The general layout, even kind of today, although a lot of that's been built over, that's what it looked like. So the Carpentaria was stream running up the top here. This is now Camp Road, and here's the road leading from Palmerston North down that way. And I suppose down here is the little junction where the shop and the petrol station is now. So in some ways, things haven't changed very much, but it was bare base, so not lots of built accommodation, big barrack blocks and facilities. It was a fairly basic camp, and I think it equates to sort of what we see in Helwan, Abbasia, and those sort of satellite camps, as we call them now, in Wairarapa. So they built beds and little huts for about 5,500 people. So that today, just inside the gate of the camp, there's a couple of 2, 4, and 8-man huts. There's a 2-man hut with modern accommodation in the background, and that's the interior of an 8-man hut, so they're pretty Spartan. You'd be marched into camp on day one of your training, they take your name, do all that sort of stuff, issue your uniforms, and then you'd stuff your pallets, your mattress, or whatever, so that you could live in that thing. Pretty cramped conditions. And the huts themselves were prefabricated, taken up by rail to Takamaru, and then they were brought into the camp and assembled on site. So Linton's gone through a lot of evolution in the 80 years. It started as the home of the 2nd Brigade, certainly the headquarters of it, of the Home Guard and Territorial Force, and it had the Central Military District Training Unit. This is the organisation that was going to take recruits through and then send them out to the different Central Military District units. So here's a snapshot in 1943, a whole lot of Armoured Corps arriving in two drafts on Monday the 3rd of May, and then a whole lot of tank transporters of the Maori contingent coming down. There's a couple of bunches of infantry. So these are all going to come down and then be put out to the different parts of the camp where they're undergoing their training. And the very first thing they do is they parade at the mess, so they get all their records taken, then they go to the mess room and they fit out their mattresses or the palliasses that they're going to sleep on. After the war, we go through a period of compulsory military training, and there's just people cycling through the camp, kind of like a non-stop training kind of organisation. The CMTs are kind of 18-year-olds, they have to register when they're 18, they get a medical test if they're fit, they just get sent to the camp, they undergo their training, and they're posted then usually to a territorial unit, often of their choice, and near their hometown where they will serve out their time. And there's usually 3 to 4 intakes per year going through, so that camp is just churning out soldiers to fill up the different units. There's a period where CMT stops and national service starts, and this is like a ballot system now. So 20-year-olds, so slightly older than the 18-year-olds that you'll see in the video clip shortly, they go through and there's a ballot. They only need 2,000 people a year, so there's a lot less than the 5,000 or so, or 7,000 to 8,000 or so required under CMT. 3 intakes per annum of about 14 weeks in length, and then they do 3 years at a territorial unit at about 20 days per annum, which is about what a territorial is expected to do now, about 20 days per annum after their recruit and core training to remain efficient. The army then evolves again, and we go away and we end up with task force regions, north, central and south. 2nd task force region is based in Linton. Then Operation Coupe is the return of 1 RNZR from Singapore and the New Zealand Force Southeast Asia. An infantry battalion comes back to Linton, joins units like School of Military Engineering and others that are there, but it starts this idea. They create a ready reaction force of regulars largely, and then that expands into an integrated expansion force, which is territorial units on a longer waiting time. That evolves to become the second land force group, and it evolves once more to be the first New Zealand Brigade, which is the unit that's in camp at the moment. But I just want to go back a few decades now. Can we go to that short video clip, please?
Stores for an issue of eating utensils and denim. Next, the quartermaster stores, where they'll get the remainder of their kit and start to look like soldiers. In my day, we took the first one they gave us and liked it. Everything a soldier wears. And now they'll have to learn the correct way to wear it. While in camp, the recruits will be billeted in four-man huts. After 6 weeks basic training, they'll be sorted out for more specialized work in artillery, engineering, signals, and many other branches. New Zealand has decided that being prepared is the only answer to threats to world peace. And anyway, a little army training never hurt anyone. A week or two of smartening up, and these lads will be the basis of a well-trained territorial army to discourage and, if necessary, resist any threatened aggression.
So those 18-year-olds, they look pretty young, 18-year-olds, in the end they're going to do 3.5 months training in Linton, and then they're going to go basically home to their local areas into a corps probably of their choice, but they'll also do further training related to that particular corps, whether it be infantry, armour, artillery, logistics. There they are arriving, pretty much saw on the video, going through the junior ranks mess there, supported, you know, cooks, giving them their meal. You can see the denim kind of uniforms that they wore. Here's the catering, these two images kind of reminded me that the camp has always had a good number of civilians from the region supporting it. In this case, they are working in the dining area, clearing up perhaps, serving food, making that work. But even today, there are civilians who work on the base, either employed by the New Zealand Defence Force or the Army, or as contractors, and it's always been that way. It's never just been a camp. It couldn't possibly be run entirely by the military, because if they were doing that, they also wouldn't be able to train. So here they are at the range, and I related that story of them, the bullets going into Mr. Keeble's farm. Nowadays, of course, is a much greater range with baffles, so you can fire and without hopefully bullets escaping into the local area. And there's some soldiers being demonstrated how to cross the ditch, swinging on the rope. There's one young fellow who's giving it a go. There's no record about whether he made it or not. But anyway, so there was a lot of shooting, physical training, all that sort of thing. This is the kind of exercise that they ran out at Foxton, and it's probably more of a demonstration for us, the sort of thing, and it was done in 1950, but this is the kind of demonstration that the Staff College students would have seen as well. So somewhere down here there's a flamethrower shooting out fire there, and a couple of other vehicles have shot around to the flank, maybe to do some kind of manoeuvre there. And you can see the tents that they're all staying in over the back, and there they all group down there watching the demonstration. And we still today, do firepower demonstrations, or we see the effect of other arms and services on the battlefield. And there's your typical intake. These guys from 1951. You can see the officer with his ribbons from the Second World War, but they're just the young fellas. This group of 36 is probably a platoon. They've gone through or are going through their training, the rifles, the Bren machine gun, Sterling submachine gun, all those sort of things, part of their training. Some other occupants of the camp that aren't widely known. The Air Force was there. They had a RNZ Air Station in Linton for a period of time. It was run as a ground training depot. And it basically closed then because Ohakia had come online and they then shifted the operation to up there. But it had a couple of base commanders. Gedge was pretty much like Perrin. He'd been in the British artillery during the First World War. He got a military cross. He transferred to the... he came out to New Zealand with his family because one of their two daughters was ill, and they thought if they came out to New Zealand it might help. But when the war started, he enlisted into the Air Force, and he was used as a base commander here, but he was also the first base commander for Ohakia when it opened up. And that's the pennant of the RNZ Air Station in Linton for the period. And we had a number of Polish refugees at Linton for a stage. I think it was in Block 5. And the reason I think, there's nothing that actually says it was, but there was a reconnaissance done on Block 5 where they were looking to change some of the battalion level buildings and some of the larger huts into apartments and things like that, where probably families or couples could at least live. Here, the mayor is giving freedom of the city to Linton Camp. It's probably the town clerk reading out the charter there. So that was on the 27th of August in 1956. The School of Military Engineering had relocated. I think it was Trentham, came up about 1953. And they had enough time to build their own big lagoon and take up most of the area there. But a lot of other schools have followed suit, and now there's quite a large number of army schools inside the Linton Camp perimeter. And this is them doing a capability display, so just like the students got back in 1942, here the engineers are showing off some of the equipment that they've got and how it's used and the sort of tasks it can undertake and the kind of time it takes to erect the bridge or fix cratering or do some demolition tasks. So by the 1970s, though, the camp was pretty shabby. Noting, a lot of the facilities are run down. It can still be there under canvas, but they're not really functioning all that well. There's a kind of a lack of maintenance. And very low numbers of people are actually starting to use the facilities. There's some other interesting bits and pieces. So this is a mock-up of a C-130. So you can see the aircraft there, but Dutchie Durandit, he's one of the staff out there at the moment. There's the tail ramp of the aircraft and the little hooks. That's the exact mock-up of the interior of the C-130, and the idea there is that movements operators can practice loading different weighted pallets, how to position them and tie them down on the aircraft so that it actually can take off and land safely. They can practice using forklifts. They can drive vehicles in there. They've replicated the whole thing to the exact dimensions. So all that can be done in Linton. You don't have to bring an aircraft down to Ohakia to do it, and you don't have to take the whole group up to Whenuapai either to get a C-130. So there's a lot of training that can be done. So last year, loads packed by army units out of Linton probably, they're on Skytrain parachuting stuff out the back of the aircraft stores. And this is tack loading, so a company from, it's me, the lieutenant on the left there, we've been tactically loaded into the back of a C-130, so instead of the 90, you probably get 140 to 150 people squished in the back, and you would do this in extremis. We're looking rather bored. It was probably really hot when we were waiting to have the ramp closed up and take off to do the thing. I only discovered this photo just a few weeks ago when Dutchie took me and showed me this, and we went back to his unit's smoko room, and he said, I've got a couple of old photo albums. And turned in about the second page I turned to was that photograph. Including Mike Hughes, became a CEO of the battalion as well. Quite an interesting photo, but it just shows the sort of training that can be done. There's lots of other little examples around Linton. So just to go to Singapore for a while, this is an aerial of the one RNZIR And in the end, Air Force Detachment Barracks and at Gear Barracks. So, you know, there would have been 500 to 700 soldiers in the battalion. It drew down to about 500 towards the end there. So a whole lot of units there with their barracks. It was the return of this organisation to Linton that sort of started a whole evolution, I think, in the Linton camp. And indeed, that area there, which is kind of the rifle company headquarters, it's almost exactly how it looks in Linton camp today. It's kind of eerie when you walk through the company headquarters, you'd think kind of like we're in Singapore apart from the temperature. But the layout, the battalion headquarters today, is an octagon in the same location as here, and we have the parade ground over the back. So, you know, I think they took back a number of the things there to Linton. So in 1953, that's what the camp looked like, the sort of units, some headquarters of at divisional artillery and armoured brigade level, a couple of medical things, a dental section to actually do dental work on the trainees that were coming through, a hospital obviously, and then an ordnance depot. So they moved from the Palmerston North Showgrounds, and big warehouses were put there to hold all the stores, and then you had that Central District's training unit churning through the recruits. So today, two groups, if you like. There's the elements of one brigade, including the headquarters. You've got the artillery regiment, the armour, the engineers, signals, infantry, logistics, health, and military police. They're the combat organisations. They are based out there now, so that brigade that Hawkins foresaw now actually exists on the camp. And indeed, the territorials are represented there with C Company of 5-7 Regiment. But also today, joining the School of Military Engineering, the School of Artillery has come down from Wairau. The Combat School is a combination of the infantry and the armour schools. They've come from Wairau down to Linton. There's a combined training centre and a defence driver training school and others. So you've got a mixture of combat deployable units alongside the training things, and that makes for a lot of efficiencies in terms of posting and staffing and things like that. So about 1,600 people on base as of now, 1,100 bed spaces, only really a lot less than the 5,000 that used to squeeze into those huts, and probably about 300 or so houses in the housing area. There was a big build of houses around the, you know, the edge of the camp towards the Kahitira stream, in time for the battalion and the other elements that had been up in Singapore to occupy when they returned. So, to summarise all of that, 80 years on from the Staff College and the establishment of Linton Camp, I think there's been, you know, those two organisations have had a huge impact. Certainly the officers that were trained, although some of them were tested by going to 3NZEF, 3 Division in the Pacific and maybe up into the Middle East for the 2nd Division, they certainly were able to operate their units. And it's been, with the establishment of Linton Camp, has really not only had a financial impact, but it's been, you know, part of the Manawatu and the massive university community for a long time, and there's been a great relationship between Massey University and the various occupants of Linton Camp over time. Geoffrey Perrin becomes Sir Geoffrey Perrin. The building that I showed you has been renamed and recently refurbished as the Sir Geoffrey Perrin Building. He developed the crossbreed of sheep, the Cheviot with the Romney. I don't really know what they are, but there's a Perrindale brand that and that's how we get the name Perrindale from there. He was knighted. He became a CBE companion in 1953, but in 1959 he was knighted as a KBE. And remained in the region. He died in Palmerston North on the 19th of July 1980. So he really did remain. He remained attached to the armoured organisations that were in Linton Camp as the colonel of the regiment, stuff like that. And then, of course, he was associated with the university for a very long time. So there's been a quite a big relationship, but we've also got the evolution of Linton. It almost went a full circle from a brigade through all that training thing. Now it's back to a brigade kind of organisation. And we also see the evolution of professional military education. So Army now, and you can see Army grade 2 or grade 3 officers there. They're doing that same technical training, but not only do they do it in the field, like in that photo I showed earlier, but they can do it, you know, computers now and imagery. You can have two-sided, an enemy group on one, and then the friendlies on the other. You can really mix and match. So that's the latest sort of training. And if we see the Staff College replicated down in Trentham, but instead of it just being Army, it's now a mixture of Army, Navy, Air Force, NZDS Civil Staff, other government agencies, and indeed a number of internationals. So not just Australia, Canada, USA and Britain, but we have had over the years students from Vietnam, Tonga, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia. So you know, there's quite a development there, and it all kind of stems back to Hawkins and Perrin, I guess, there. Just, that is the last slide, but I just wanted to make the point there. Peter Cook and John Crawford, their book, John Mormon's article, but also the Tamero site of the Massey University Archives, all those three have been particularly helpful there for anybody who wants to follow anything up. So, oops. I'm now happy to take questions of this time, Joe, but also anybody who wants to make a bit of a comment about Lipton, if they want to, or anything, I'm more than happy to take any questions or comments. Yes?
You, earlier in the talk, you were talking about the threat of Japanese invasion. Were, a couple of questions, were any plans, Japanese plans actually uncovered at any stage?
No.
And was the threat seen that they would attack on the sort of Otaki Manawatu coast where the beaches were, because they were close to Wellington? Was that the perceived threat?
Okay, no, so Hawkins made an assessment that they might land or that they might see support. So landing of a Japanese division, not only would it require aircraft carriers to provide aircraft air support, but it would, they estimated about 30 ships. So probably it would be in a port or the area around Auckland or maybe down in Wellington. Other possibilities seem to be seizing North Auckland and then threatening Auckland, or maybe even seizing the top of the South Island, the Sounds, and then threatening Wellington. No plans were ever uncovered. The assessment then became probably raiders and indeed aircraft, reconnaissance aircraft, I think overflew Auckland and Wellington on a couple of occasions, and also the Germans, a German surface raider, or mine layer came in and made sea mines in the area of the Hauraki Gulf, you know, again to try and stop. So there was never an actual plan by the Japanese to land. I believe one of the Japanese commanders was interviewed shortly after the war and pretty much clarified their question. There was no actual intention. They would happily stay in New Guinea and bomb Darwin and other things from there, but they never intended to come all the way down to New Zealand. Certainly excited a lot of people for the possibility of a threat and galvanised a lot of people to, you know, the recent events the same, you know, to join the defence force and, against the possibility. But as soon as they reached a tipping point where they realised the Japanese weren't or couldn't, I think a lot of the interest sort of started to drop off, and that was reflected also in, you know, the closure of the Staff College and things like that.
Can I just make a comment, Peter? Thank you for that conversation. I work at Massey University now, and I sit in the Sujifu Perrin building, and it has been beautifully refurbished, and I'm delighted to share with you that the refectory, which has had significant fundraising and things done, has also just been finished its refurbishment. So Massey's certainly recognising the heritage value of those buildings, so that's really great.
I'm really pleased.
Yeah, I think that we also considered commemorating the 80th anniversary by holding a function in the new refurbished refectory, but COVID squashed that. But certainly we're in discussions with the University Foundation And in fact, Mitch Murdoch was supposed to be here today to see if we can actually do that at some stage later this year. Great opportunity for something that goes back to, you know, its use in 1942-43. Yeah. It's a beautiful building.
Yeah, beautiful area, but you know, most students will, and you couldn't expect, wouldn't know. But it's great that they've been looked after. Hopefully there'll be some information there that people can just reflect on their time.
Any other sort of comments from individuals' experiences in Linton Camp? Because I know there are a number here.
Just a comment on Geoffrey Perrin. His remains are at Kelvin Grove Cemetery. And I was looking at his plaque the other day, and he also has a French decoration, Collingwood.
Yep.
And also, his son, Roger Perrin, was in the 1970s the High Commissioner in Singapore.
Ah.
So he had a very close contact with the military that were in Singapore at that time.
And that relationship has continued and is still strong. We have a Singaporean student on the staff at the moment. I think Geoffrey Perrin's Croix de Guerre was awarded from E, and he was nominated elsewhere for the Military Cross, so he certainly was a gallant, brave officer, but clearly not just an academic but a scientist as well, and very good on the military side, and a great organiser, motivator of getting things done. So, you know, we were very lucky, and you do wonder if it wasn't perhaps for Williams coming out, the general, maybe Hawkins being selected if it was a different officer, you know, Perrin maybe just not joining the military or not coming to New Zealand. Things could have been a lot differently, but all those sort of things lined up, and we've ended up with a pretty good result. Yeah.
So, there's a park in Rupert Drive dedicated to it, and there's a big write up about him as well.
Okay, cool.
Yes,
I didn't know that was something.
Yes.
In fact, we've just, the council at the moment is just working in putting in a Turitea special heritage area so that we can actually preserve. A lot of the research was done by Massey University initially around the area of the Massey Oval, but that is now going through a plan change with the City Council so that the area can be protected, and that contains the Oval and all of the surrounding buildings, including the refectory, McCarty Hall, the old Pink Hostel, the accommodation buildings, and so on, because of the importance of that heritage. Should see something come up later on this year once that plan change has been effected. A lot of history there. It's also interesting the interrelationship between the falsehood about Whairata, which was where the staff college was, and I think a lot of people keep spreading that rumour, but also the link with Keisha Birch. And again, if we won Lotto, we'd probably buy out Acacia Birch and convert that into our military heritage establishment for Palmerston North. But watch this space. Any other comments about Linton or questions?
My late father was a dispatch rider during the Second World War, and he relates the fact that the faster they were building those huts, they had more guards on it because the Colchester projectors were actually going to bring them down. I don't know how true that is, but the
Yeah, any of you, anybody or any of us who've experienced living in those huts, I can tell you, they certainly were an experience. And in fact, eventually they put electric bar heaters in there to try, or the tubular heaters, which were so-called safe, to try and keep you warm. It was pretty miserable in the winter, I can tell you that. And then running to the ablutions and the showers, you know, cracking the ice and the frost on it. Great memories. Any other comments? Yep.
Similar huts like that out at, I think it's called Camp Rangi Woods at Pahonglinda. Did they come
yes.
from Linton, or were they just similar?
Yeah, quite a few of them have actually been relocated. You know, as you go on the road out to Bulls, on the main road, on the left-hand side, before I converted Dairy Factory, in amongst a bit of bush, native bush there used to be several of those army huts. And quite a number of them were actually picked up and relocated all around the place.
The men's shed down in Rangitani Park, down Racecourse Road, that was relocated. Mike, was that block 3 or block 4?
That was the headquarters. Block 4.
Block 4, yeah, that came out of there and is now a thriving establishment. Yeah, there are a number of other places around town or around the area, around the Manawatū, that have got old huts and bits and pieces of old buildings and so on. Did you want to add anything, Mike?
Yeah, I remember people ringing me up wanting an army hut. I think I donated about 30 round the local farming area over time.
Yeah.
And then the one the city council. One of the mess buildings went to the Marae up the back of Helpham. So,
yeah. Yeah, the stuff's been all over the place before I got caught. Another interesting experience, when I worked at Defence Headquarters, I was the project officer for Operation Coupe, which was the return of the battalion from Singapore in the late 70s, and then I ended up in Singapore as the force engineer, you know, operating in and around the Dieppe area and having a close study of that, and then coming back to New Zealand again as the director of works looking at the re-establishment of and the return of the battalion. So I went through that full cycle over a period of about 15 years, so some interesting history and experience there, Peter. Yeah. Any other questions anybody wants to ask about the staff college or about Linton Camp? And we're still out there, we'd like to know. Yeah. All right, well, look, can I close off by thanking Peter, and would you please all join me in the usual way?